Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
Good to have you here in show number 62.
Uh-huh.
And we just listened to a brief recap of last week's show and talking about the beginning of that wonderful United Nations.
Right. Yeah, we were talking about the agreement at Yalta.
Yes.
And how that sets up sort of the framework for the post-war world. Remembering that the war is still going on, hasn't yet quite come to an end, and both in Europe and in Asia, the war is raging on. But it's pretty obvious that the handwriting is on the wall as far as Europe is concerned. And so the first thing that was agreed upon was a reestablishment of some kind of a world order, world system. In the case of the League of Nations, it had failed. It didn't have any teeth, and so the United Nations organization was then established with the intention of having a world body that would be able to prevent this kind of war from ever happening again. And we looked at the elements of that and how that was put together. Then after that, the three negotiators, in a sense, the three world leaders who were at Yalta, that being Joseph Stalin, who is the leader of the Soviet Union and the host of the meeting. He and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who is quite ill at this point, remember that he'll be dying in just a couple months. And then also Winston Churchill, representing Great Britain. And the three of them then have discussed the United Nations. Then they turn their attentions to Poland, which becomes a very important issue also. And, you know, in some ways, perhaps we underestimate the importance of Poland in European affairs, because it's when Poland turns away from communism that the entire communist empire of the Soviet Union collapses, and perhaps it's more important than what we tend to give credit for. The frontiers were placed. Basically, Poland was kept as a nation, which is something in and of itself, because from time to time throughout modern history, Poland simply disappears off the map and is assumed by its neighbors. But Poland is going to be its own country. It shifts the boundaries toward the west considerably. So parts of what had been Germany are now part of Poland, though Poles would point out the fact that that part of Germany had been part of Poland before the Germans took it from them. And so in a sense, there's a return of that. And then part of Poland is now brought into the Soviet Union. What's more important, perhaps, is that there are two groups of Poles, and you have the Poles. They're nicknamed the London Poles, because this is the government that had fled in exile at the time of the fall of Poland in 1939, and they went to England. They went to London. They gathered as much strength as they could, and they cooperated. They fought side by side with the Allies throughout the war. In fact, Polish paratroopers played a significant part in Operation Market Garden toward the end of the war up in the Netherlands, and they died in considerable numbers in order to defeat Nazism. And so that's one group of Poles. And then the other group of Poles is called the Lublin Poles. And these are communist Poles. So you've got the Democrats versus the communists. And interestingly enough, very right at the end of the war, the Western Allies sell out those Poles who had fought so hard and in order to bring about a peace and a settlement in Eastern Europe, they allowed Stalin to have his way in Poland. This is one more Polish tragedy among so many.
Suffering people, aren't they?
Oh, they are. Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And you know, every time they do something right, they get kicked in the teeth for it. You know, I think about Jan Sobolewski taking an army down, saved Vienna from the Turks, and then within a couple generations, the Austrians repay the compliment by cutting up Poland into three parts and taking a third of it. Well, you know, to add to this, too, it's pretty obvious that that the massacre that had been discovered during the Second World War in eastern Poland, called the Katyn Forest Massacre, was in fact not a Nazi propaganda coup, but in fact was a real event. And what happened was this. When Poland was divided into two by the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, this was in the summer of 1939, right before the war itself began, and they decided that they would divide Poland in two. In the eastern half of that country, intellectuals, teachers, army officers, priests, everybody that any kind of leadership in the eastern part of Poland was rounded up by the Soviets, and they were taken off to a field and were shot. And when Hitler invaded Russia on his way in, they came across this forest, which had only been planted just a couple years earlier. So there's all lots of little trees, and they thought something was sneaky here. Something was up. Something was fishy. And so what they did was they began digging in that forest, and they began discovering mass graves. And so what happens is then the German army sends word to the International Red Cross to come in and monitor this. The International Red Cross wouldn't have anything to do with this, assuming this was propaganda. And so ultimately it was the German Red Cross that dug up these bodies and authenticated the massacre. We're talking over 10,000 people.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, 10,000 people. And this was the leadership of eastern Poland. Yeah. And by the time the war came to an end, it was now known that the Soviets had done this. It was not a piece of Nazi propaganda. You know, of course, the Nazis pointing a finger at this, as if they had a big finger to point at anybody. But nonetheless, it's a reality. And what happens is that in 1944, 1945, the Western Allies quietly put this aside. Nobody talks about the Katyn Forest until the 1950s or 60s. In 1944, when the Red Army was moving into Poland and just outside the suburbs of Warsaw, in order to help them, Poles in Warsaw rose up in rebellion against the Nazis to throw them off. Now, this is an important fact, because if the Nazis had been able to hold on to the city, the Red Army would have to have taken that city like they did in Stalingrad, street by street and house by house and factory by factory, and it would have been terribly bloody. So the Poles handed the Red Army, the Communist Army, a wonderful opportunity. You know what they did? The Soviets stopped the attack and allowed the Germans to bring reinforcements in to crush the Polish rebellion. Once again, it's an insidious act on their part. What they're doing is they're allowing the leadership of Poland to be slaughtered, this time at the hands of the Nazis. The best that the two Western Allies, could get out of Stalin by way of some kind of compromise was an agreement that there would be a free elections in 1945. But in actuality, those elections were not free.
Mm-hmm.
They were monitored by the Red Army. All throughout Eastern Europe, you see the same tragedy taking place over and over and over again. These spheres of influence, of Soviet influence, were set up to rebuild and establish governments through, well, at Yalta they said they would be through elections, but they were through fake elections. You've got the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. Added to that, Romania and Bulgaria are going to come under the sphere of the Soviet Union. Only in Greece does the United States and Great Britain have some kind of influence and control. No one could decide at that point about Hungary, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia. At Yalta, those three countries were up in the air. Now, Hungary is an interesting case because it had been part of the Axis, the Nazi alliance system. And so, and we've already talked about Admiral Horthy and Archbishop Rota and the fate of the Jews in Hungary. Ultimately, Hungary will be liberated by the Red Army, and so it's going to come under communist influence, whether it likes it or not. In Yugoslavia, on the other hand, the Yugoslavs themselves are going to liberate their country from the German and Italian forces. This will be under Marshal Tito. And when the Soviet Union wants to move in to stabilize that area, basically Tito, who is himself a communist, tells the Soviet Union, thanks, but no thanks. We've already done it ourselves, and we'll call you if we need you. Yeah. Czechoslovakia looks like it's going to be on the path of democracy, free elections. And then a very unfortunate thing happened, the so-called suicide of Jan Masaryk, who was one of the great leaders, the pre-war leaders of Czechoslovakia. It's a case in which he fell out of a hotel room many stories up. It was ruled by the police that it was a suicide. But the evidence shows that he didn't open the window when he fell out, and he seems to have beaten himself up all throughout the room and destroyed a lot of the furniture in the hotel room in the process of beating himself up before he threw himself out. Interesting case. That case will come back to bite later on, because when the Czechs have an opportunity to breathe freely again, one of the first things they're going to do is launch an investigation into the so-called suicide of Jan Masaryk, and that causes some embarrassment and difficulties. Then they turned their attention to Germany. Germany was being invaded both by the Red Army in the east and by the British and the Americans in the west, and it was just a matter of time. And so Stalin presented his plan, and he suggested that that Germany be divided up into three countries, that it would not stay united. Remember that Germany was only united in 1870, so it's only been a country for about 75 years. And so the idea that Stalin had was that it would be divided up into three little countries. He had Prussia in the north, Bavaria in the south, and then what he refers to as the International Rhinish Federation in the west along the Rhine River. Of course, you know, his idea behind this is he's thinking down the line. He's a good chess player, and he's always thinking two or three moves ahead. And his thought is that if I can have a very weak Germany, then after I've consolidated myself in Poland and the other Eastern Europeans, I can now then move in, and basically, you know, communism should be on the Rhine River before too long. Right. And then it's just a matter of uniting up with rather large and potent communist parties in France and in Italy. And, of course, Spain is still smarting under the dictatorship of Francisco Franco, but that civil war was not too many years earlier. He's looking at a red Europe. Britain would be the only country left that would not be. Obviously, the British and the Americans had different ideas on that. And they both agreed that Germany should be divided temporarily and that it should then be brought back together again. The American plan for this, interestingly enough, was that Germany would be divided into three parts. The eastern part would be controlled by the Soviet Union. And their idea was that the southern part would be controlled by Great Britain and the northern part controlled by the United States.
Oh, okay.
The industrial part. Also, where the port cities are. Now, Churchill plays chess, too, and he realizes that if the Americans are able to be that close to ports, that, you know, enough domestic pressure, and they can withdraw their army and come back to the United States and go back into their isolationism, and he doesn't want to see that to happen. And so he suggests instead that Germany be divided temporarily into four parts. The eastern part going to the Soviet Union to control, the southern part going to the United States. So we got hemmed in, although we ended up with the most beautiful area, basically the Bavaria and the Schwäbische Alb and Black Forest and all that. A little wedge would go to France.
Okay.
And then the British would have the northern industrial part.
Okay.
And in fact, that's the way the map of Germany is drawn at the very beginning. They also agreed that they needed to have a denazification program, which would be an alternative. The governments that would be set up, there would be collaborative governments with the occupying forces, that these governments would not include former Nazis. As it turns out, this becomes practically impossible because Nazism in 12 years had spread all throughout Germany so that you couldn't be anybody of any importance in Germany unless you belonged to the party or you collaborated in some way. And so in the end, all of them kind of backed off from that commitment. I think all of them except for the Soviets. The Soviets really took this thing very seriously. But the others, it was a balancing act. Not unlike what's happening in Iraq even today. After a year, basically, of having nothing to do with former Baathists, mm-hmm. We're finding that there are good Baathists and bad Baathists because mm-hmm. the Ba'ath Party in Iraq basically had the same insidious nature that that the Nazi Party had in Germany.
Right.
You know? Right. The question of economics comes up. The American fellow by the name of Morgenthau had suggested that Germany be reduced to 60 million shepherds, you know, knock them back in the Stone Age. Stalin sort of liked the idea, I think. Basically, before it was all over, something like $10 billion worth of industry and stuff was simply packed up and moved out of Germany back to back to the Soviet Union. $10 billion. Also, the use of slave labor for the reconstruction of the Soviet Union. This was certainly true about the German soldiers who were captured in the Soviet Union. The vast majority of them never saw their families again. They died in Russia.
Hmm.
Churchill had a very different idea. His idea was to keep Germany united and rebuild Germany. Now, Churchill has the exact opposite notion of Central Europe as Stalin. Stalin wants a weak, vacuumous Central Europe so that he can go in and fill the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Churchill wants a strong Central Europe, especially a strong Germany, which would act as a buffer for the spread of Central Europe. All of this is left on the table. Not much is actually decided. Another question came up about Austria. Once again, they decided that Austria would become its own country. It would not stay part of Germany. It would be divided temporarily between the four and ultimately would be reunited into a small, independent, neutral country. Austria is a lovely little country to visit. It's great in tourism. It's hobbled by the fact that it has one very large city and one very small country. And Austria will always, if Austria stays the way it will, and it seems like it will, it will always be just a lovely place to visit. But it's never going to be a world power.
Mm-hmm.
True, not everybody wants to be, by the way.
True.
Yeah.
I would suppose there are advantages to that.
Yeah, there probably are,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Japan is the next question that was dealt with at Yalta. And it was decided that 2 months after victory in Europe, that 2 months after that, the Soviet Union promised to declare war on Japan. Now, that's an interesting point because because Japan was not at war with the Soviet Union. As we fought throughout the Second World War, those two were on opposite sides as far as alliances go. But what happened was when Japan attacked the United States, Hitler declared war on the United States. He didn't have to because the Axis alliance was a defensive alliance, but he did anyway. And the Japanese did not return the compliment when he invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941. Instead, they had held out neutrality. Now, why he declared war on the United States is beyond me. Except that perhaps he was trying to convince the Japanese to throw their lot in entirely with him. But the fact is that in December 7th, 1941, they didn't. And the day after that, Hitler did. And so the anomaly of all of this ends up that in 1945, these two powers that are fighting to the death are not at war with each other.
Uh-huh.
You know, but they will be. After victory in Europe, Stalin promises to shift the entire, part of the Red Army to the east. And he's promised for that basically the pre-1903 boundaries of what had been the Russian Empire. Russia and Japan had fought a war. It was a disaster is the Russo-Japanese War. It was a disaster for the Russians, and they had lost a lot of territory. They're now promised all that territory back if they join in the war. Well, what happens then afterwards, the flow of events, is that Europe falls. Okay, the first part of May, the what's left of Nazi Germany surrenders to the Allies, West and East. Then there's a series of stunning victories in the East, in East Asia. You've got the Battle of Leyte Gulf in the Philippines, in which the Japanese Navy, for all practical purposes, is destroyed. And so the Japanese Empire of what they referred to as the East Asian Co-Prosperity Sphere, which was basically the extension of their empire, without a navy, that simply shrivels. Then you have the Battle of Okinawa, which is the last chance to save Japan. And that's a disaster. The United States Marines fight a very hard fight and take that island, the southern part of Japan. Now Japan's mainland now is open to invasion. The Admiral Suzuki goes to the Japanese cabinet and sues for peace. The Emperor Hirohito agrees with that. And so on June 20th of 1945, they send a special emissary to the Soviet Union to act as their go-between with the Western powers to set up a peace negotiations to bring an end to the war in the Pacific. They went to the wrong people, because the Soviets had already promised that they're chomping at the opportunity of taking that territory back from the Japanese. And so, of course, nothing actually happens.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviets simply ignored the whole thing. Roosevelt dies. He's succeeded by Harry Truman. And Truman is so far left out of the loop that when he was made president, he was given all this secret information. This is the first time he heard about the development of the atomic bomb, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. He wants to use it as soon as possible against Japan so as to take Japan out of the war. And what happens is that there is this like foot race going on right now. He wants to end the war before the Soviets declare war.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what's happening then. Not everybody around Truman agrees with using this bomb. The Secretary of War, Stimson, wanted to use it, as well as the chief of staff, George Marshall, wanted to use it also. As soon as it would be operational, they wanted to use this as a way to demonstrate to the Japanese that they needed to surrender unconditionally to them right away. And the hope is to do it within 2 months of VE Day so the Soviets don't have the opportunity to come in and join the war.
Mm-hmm.
This is not universal. Admiral Leahy, on the other hand, had been arguing in favor of what is called the Blue Water Strategy, which was to set up a blockade around Japan and force Japan to surrender. But that would take months. It would probably be not effective until 1946. But Leahy says this, and it's, you know, at the dawn of the nuclear age, it's rather prophetic. He says, "My own feeling was that in being the first to use it, the atomic bomb, we had adopted an ethical standard common to the barbarians of the Dark Ages. I was not taught to make war in that fashion, and wars cannot be won by destroying women and children." Mm. Well, in a sense, it was, in the two uses of those. What follows afterwards is the very rapid use of the only two weapons we had. We had three. One we used at Los Alamos to see whether it would work or not, and then we had two others. And there were five targets that were chosen. Ultimately, as we know in history, Hiroshima and Nagasaki came to be the ones used, partially because they had military installations there, and partially because most of the buildings in both of those cities were wood and paper, and it would make the devastation look all the worse.
Mm.
You would not want to use this in Tokyo, because Tokyo, for all practical purposes, had already been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
There simply wasn't much left. And so what happens is, this very quick chronology, on August 6th of 1945, an atomic bomb is dropped in Hiroshima. Something like 25% of the population of that city is killed. Ultimately, about 80,000 people.
Wow.
On the 8th of August, the Soviet Union declared war on Japan. On the 9th of August, a bomb was dropped at Nagasaki. On the 10th of August, Japan sued for unconditional surrender on the condition that the emperor be allowed to stay. And ultimately, that's what we'll accept. And the argument has gone on ever since. What caused the Japanese to surrender on August 10th?
Right.
And American historians have always said, well, it was the dropping of the two atomic bombs. And Soviet historians had always argued that it was the declaration of war by the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
and they could use that. But the fact of the matter is that had the Soviets not come in, and had we not dropped those bombs, or had we dropped the bombs and not had the effect that brought about the surrender, the invasion of Japan would have been an absolute bloodbath. And you talk to anybody who was over there, any of those Marines over there, or Navy or Army, looking at the invasion of mainland Japan, it would have been horrendous. My father had been on Okinawa and had fought in that and two other battles, previous battles, and he told me many years ago how they were surprised at the number of coffins that had been already prepared for his division, his Marine division. And he was talking with some of the officers. Now, this was after Japan had surrendered and they were on Japanese soil. And he said that his unit, which would have been the first unit in on the beachhead, they were expecting 85% casualties.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is absolutely phenomenal. You know, so that debate continues on. But anyhow, right before that, you have another meeting that takes place between the big leaders. And this time around, it's going to be in Germany itself, in the city of Potsdam. It's a suburb of Berlin. It's kind of a gutsy thing for these guys to do this when you think about it. I mean, Lord, Germany's just been defeated a couple months earlier, and here Joseph Stalin goes to Berlin. Harry Truman, he's now replaced Roosevelt. Clement Attlee goes to replace he goes to represent Great Britain because, believe it or not, Winston Churchill is elected out of office.
Mm-hmm.
After having saved Great Britain, mm-hmm. he's elected out of office. Attlee, there's a funny little thing about him. Truman contacted Roosevelt and said Woodrow Wilson, who I'm getting my people all mixed up, Winston Churchill. And he said to him, you won't be at Potsdam. What can I expect out of Clement Attlee? And Churchill, in his typical Churchillian demeanor, said back to Truman, now, you have to understand that Clement Attlee was a short, bald fellow, skinny little guy, and he was just nondescript. And anyhow, Churchill says, with Clement Attlee, there is much less there than appears. Anyhow, the three gather together, and there are a series of decisions that are made. Again, first of all, the question of Italy comes up. They all agree that Italy now is purged of fascism. It was invited to join the United Nations. Stalin is not unhappy with this because the Italians have a very strong communist party, mm-hmm. and there's a chance that they could take over. Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary are also invited to take seats in the United Nations. The question of Spain came up, and the Soviet Union insisted that Spain not be allowed to join the United Nations. It would not until the 1970s. With the death of Franco. In Poland, here we have, once again, the establishment of these westernized boundaries. The communists get 14 seats in the cabinet. That's the Lublin Poles. The London Poles get 7. It's pretty obvious as you're going into in the end of the summer of 1945 that Poland is not going to look well. The question came up of the German population in Poland, because Western Poland, particularly around Danzig or Gdańsk, and then in Silesia, was heavily German,
mm-hmm.
and there was something like 8 million ethnic Germans, Volksdeutsch, living in that area. And the question came up to Stalin: what is going to become of these 8 million people? And his response was, "Oh, don't worry about them; they've all moved." Which is not entirely untrue, because huge numbers of people fled in front of the Red Army,
mm-hmm.
as it marched through Poland and into Germany. But it's an incredible displacement, 8 million people displaced.
Oh.
You know. Germany itself, as they're looking at this, the question of reunification, they decided to put that off. They have an understanding that they're going to have local self-government, and they're going to have to compromise a little bit on this whole denazification thing. They also decided that there would be a coordination between the four sectors in economy, transportation, and the rebuilding of industry. This does not take place. The Soviets will play hardball on this, and the other three ultimately will simply begin cooperating, and that's how you ended up with an East Germany and a West mm-hmm. Germany, which we'll be looking at a little bit. And then Austria itself was decided that they would have free access, and the Austrian unification was moving along pretty nicely. As we shift our focus, now what we've done right now, Teresa, is we've taken a look at 1945.
Mm-hmm.
It's a stellar and shocking year. We go through the spring of 1945 and see the collapse of Nazism and the triumph of the Allies in the West. As we go through the summer of 1945, we see stellar victories on the part of the American and British forces, by and large, in the Pacific. And then that's culminated with the use of an atomic weapon, which is underestimated by just about everybody except the scientists who have put this thing together. When Truman told Stalin that he had a super secret weapon that he was about to use against Japan while they were at Potsdam, Stalin did not act as though he was totally surprised at this and said, "Oh, well, that's wonderful. Good luck with it." You know, no, nobody, until you saw those mushrooms and the incredible devastation that happened afterwards, there's no way that you could have understood what this thing actually meant. Mm-hmm. And perhaps by the use of it so early on in its development, it scared everybody to their bejeevers not to use it again. Mm-hmm. And so we spared ourselves in some ways a nuclear exchange that could have led to the deaths of tens of millions of people. Unknowingly, by the time we entered 1946, we knew we had an incredibly dangerous weapon here.
Right.
And then let's start looking at the rehealing of wounds in Western Europe. And in doing that, I'd like to go ahead and read a little paragraph from Gaudium et Spes. Now, here are people 20 years after the after this event, and they're looking at the importance of people who disagree with each other finding ways to live together. And so this is Article 28 in Gaudium et Spes. And they say the following: "Those also have a claim on our respect and charity who think and act differently from us in social, political, and religious matters. In fact, the more deeply we come to understand their ways of thinking through kindness and love, the more easily will we be able to enter into dialogue with them. Love and courtesy of this kind should not, of course, make us indifferent to truth and goodness. Love, in fact, impels the followers of Christ to proclaim to all men the truth which saves. But we must distinguish between the error, which we always reject, and the person in error, who never loses his dignity as a person, even though he flounders amid false and inadequate religious ideas. God alone is to judge and to search, and the searcher of hearts. He forbids us to pass judgment on the inner guilt of others. The teachings of Christ even demands that we forgive injury, and the precept of love, which is the commandment of the new law, includes all our enemies. You have heard it said that you should love your enemy and love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, do good to them that hate you, and pray for those who persecute and calumniate you." That's a high ideal.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, when it's applied to reality, as in Western Europe, it brings about great prosperity and great friendship and great peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it would be possible in every other case. But we see it in action in what happens. Germany is a huge enemy in the 20th century, mm-hmm. has fought two world wars. It alone is responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of American soldiers, hundreds of thousands of American soldiers. And yet, when the war comes to an end, unlike the First World War, which was culminated in a treaty of vengeance and hate, what happens at the end of the Second World War is an atmosphere of forgiveness and solidarity. Right from the very beginning, as we were just mentioned, even after Potsdam, shortly after that, you find the Americans, the British, and the French cooperating with each other and cooperating with the German populations that are there in pulling together in the basic infrastructure of a totally destroyed country and in rebuilding that. Now, it takes a couple years. In fact, it's going to take about 2 years before there's any kind of real stability in Germany. It's an interesting lesson for us, those who are, you know, those of us who are very anxious and want rapid development in Iraq. We can look to the German example in that. It takes a couple years, and not 1 year, but a couple years for things to stabilize. There is an insurgency in Germany. It's not as well known, but there was an insurgency in Germany of ex-Nazis, hangers-on, who were involved in assassinations and in terror plots, even, I believe, in one case, even a bombing. Weren't suicide bombers, but in bombing. And it's called they call themselves the werewolves. And ultimately, they were rooted out. But it's going to take a while. And it's going to take into 1947 or so before finally the Western powers, the three Western powers, have had it with the Soviets. They realize that they're dragging their feet, and they don't want a united Germany. And so finally the three powers gather together in what's called the Paris Agreement, and they establish among the British, French, and American zone the Federal Republic of Germany. The Soviet Union reacts against this, and in 1948 refused to either allow their section, their eastern sector, to join, and not only that, or even to talk. And so the transportation communication links to Berlin were cut off. Remember that Berlin itself is divided into four sectors, mm-hmm. and it's vitally important in order to be able to get, you have to get back and forth. And now the Soviets have blocked this and not allowed it in. General Lucius Clay suggests that that an operation be undertaken in order to break this blockade, and that that planes be flown in to Berlin, to Tempelhof Airport, and to supply the German people. And at the same time that a tank column force its way through the Soviet zone and open up the railways and the Autobahn to Berlin. Truman decided to go for the airlift and forget the tanks. Mm-hmm. It would undoubtedly have precipitated a military conflict that could have led to a war. And honestly, we didn't have the troops there to be able to confront the huge, giant Red Army that was sitting there. And unless we were willing to use nuclear bombs on them. Mm-hmm. And honestly, the American people didn't have the will to go and fight yet another war. We were sick and tired. We wanted to have a little peace. Mm-hmm. And the troops just wanted to come home. Mm-hmm. So the airlift itself was all that we did, but it was very successful. Something like 8,000 tons of food and coal were flown into West Berlin. It was an incredible demonstration of American power and American wealth. No other nation in the world could afford to fly coal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just spoke to the Germans that we had that kind of money to throw around, that we would fly coal. And you have pictures all the time of little kids as the American planes are coming over into the suburbs, into Berlin itself, little children gathering around. And the reason they were doing that was that the pilots, as they were coming in for their landings, were opening windows and throwing chocolate bars mm-hmm. out the windows. In fact, chocolate bars, Hershey's chocolate bars and American cigarettes, it for a short while, actually became the currency of Western Germany. It was more available than money. Wow. Was. And also, an interesting thing, I mean, Germany is famous for its chocolates, and of course Switzerland is very famous for its chocolates, and yet there is an element of a generation of people now in their 70s, 60s and 70s, who actually prefer Hershey's chocolates to this expensive Pure European chocolates because they were basically raised on this American chocolate.
Well, and what a memory as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They would we'd be willing to sacrifice and come in and assist them in such great need.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was a tremendous confrontation that was happening there.
Mm-hmm.
In Western Germany, they began forming together political parties, and basically they were the same parties that had been in the pre-war. They simply resurrected, mm-hmm. except for the Communist Party. Communist Party in the Western Germany never had much of a chance. It was never outlawed, but you know nobody had much of an affection for communism.
Been there, done that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And they could see the disastrous results on the other side that were taking place. The Social Democrats reorganized. They had suffered grievously under the Nazis. They come back under Kurt Schumacher. He had spent 12 years in Nazi concentration camps.
Wow.
And so he had a lot of respect. A lot of people had a great respect for him. Now, remember that the Social Democrats, their political philosophy would be attuned perhaps to the left wing of the American Democratic Party.
Okay.
They're thinking in terms of that. Their counterpart is the Christian Democratic Union, the CDU, which is the old center party, and this is under the leadership of Konrad Adenauer. And he had been the mayor of Cologne throughout the Second World War, throughout the Nazi period, and he is one of those, like Bishop von Galen, that Hitler would love to have gotten his hands on, but was afraid to touch.
Mm-hmm.
And so he survived the entire Nazi period as an anti-Nazi. He's 69 years old at this point, but he's still vigorous enough to put together the CDU. And the Christian Democrats, one would, as you're trying to find a parallel in American politics, would probably be similar to moderate Republicans.
Okay.
And then there's another party also, the FDP, which is the Free Democratic Party, which is actually would be similar to the right wing of the Republican Party.
Okay.
In 1949, elections take place. Here again, it's an interesting parallel with Iraq. We're wanting elections within a year and a half of. We have an interim government already, just a year after the invasion. We're wanting a permanent election within a year and a half of the invasion. In Germany, they waited 4 years before they 4 years before they had an election, in just the western part. And as I say, the Adenauer and the Christian Democrats will win this. By 1952, so 7 years after the invasion, 7 years later, then the occupation comes to an end, and the German government, West German government, asked the occupiers to stay as allies.
Okay.
And so what had been the great enemy
mm-hmm.
Now becomes a friend. In 1951, the Germany will join the European Coal and Steel Community. They will do that in conjunction with their ancient enemy, France. The two of them now will become partners in building a peaceful, prosperous Western Europe. Germany in 1952, with the occupation coming to an end, gets its own army, 500,000 strong, an independent foreign policy with close ties, especially to the United States. There's a long-standing love affair between the United States and Germany that takes place after, around 1952 and all the way down until just rather recently. It was during the Reagan administration that there were difficulties and disagreements on the placement of medium-range ballistic missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed like a little spat. And then currently, of course, there's a spat over U.S. And German foreign policy regarding Iraq. But outside of that, there's been a long-standing love affair between the two countries. And it stems back to the end of World War II and how the victorious Allies treated the Germans. In fact, as you go into the 1950s, the United States and Great Britain actually helped Germany to rearm. Isn't that something? I mean, within 10 years, you know. In 1955, Germany is invited, West Germany is invited to join the organization that has now come about in Western Europe to counterbalance the Soviet Union. This is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, and Germany becomes a member of that. It's in that same year that West Germany negotiates a return of troops from the Soviet Union, and it's a very small amount. I think it's something like 10,000.
Wow.
Troops, and all the rest of them have disappeared into the gulags. First under Adenauer, and then under Ludwig Erhard, Germany begins massive rebuilding. This is done through American money, through the Marshall Plan. And productivity is just phenomenal. Between 1948 and 1964, German productivity, or production, the gross domestic product, increased over that 16-year period 600%.
Wow.
Of course, you know, they weren't starting with much to begin with.
Right, true. But.
And great big firms, the kind of firms that that we've come to identify with German companies, are on the rise. Volkswagen is reestablished, and in Wolfsburg, now they actually do build cars. During the war, they really never got around to building cars. They were building their equivalent of Jeeps and trucks and things like that for the war effort. But now they're actually beginning to build the cars for the people. And Bayer, the great pharmaceutical company, famous, of course, for its aspirin, but lots of other things. Siemens, the electrical engineering firm, the electrical apparatus firm, is reestablished itself. Interestingly enough, another chemical firm, an industrial chemical firm, comes back to the embarrassment of many people, IG Farben.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, IG Farben had made lots of money off of slave labor at Auschwitz-Birkenau. It's got an ugly history to it. But it also comes back. In fact, they're so successful that they get to a point in Germany in the mid-1960s of overemployment. In other words, they had more jobs than workers.
Wow.
And so they tried to solve that domestically by getting Germans to work harder, which is usually pretty easy. They're pretty industrious people, but there's limits.
Yeah.
And ultimately what they ended up doing was inviting other foreign nationals to come in.
Okay.
And this becomes the guest worker program, the Gastarbeitern program, and which the Germans now today view with mixed feelings. Because as a result of this guest worker program, you have huge numbers of foreigners who are permanently part of the German landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was told by a young Bosnian woman here in St. Louis, she had been in Berlin for a couple years, had fled Bosnia during that terrible civil war, and she stayed a couple years in Berlin, fluent in German and doing quite well, but she migrated to the United States basically to poverty, to have to learn another language and get started all over again. And I said, why didn't you just stay in Germany? You know, and she said, interesting point, she said, if I lived in Germany my entire life, I would never be a German. And she said, my children would probably never be considered German either.
Mm-hmm.
But here in the United States, as soon as I learn English, I'm going to be an American. You know, it's two different societies,
sure. Mm-hmm.
Two different approaches. But anyway, you have that huge guest worker program. And to show the vibrant nature of German democracy, in 1969, the mayor of Berlin, who is a social democrat, wins the election as chancellor, and that's Willy Brandt. And he begins a whole different way of looking at foreign policy. The CDU was tied very closely to the United States. Willy Brandt has what he calls the Ostpolitik, looking to the east and trying to build better relations with the Eastern Bloc countries. So there's the beginnings then of this founding of, at least, I mean, the German question, which is the great question of the 19th and 20th century, seems then to be well on its way to being solved. And I think Gaudium et Spes speaks again, that one paragraph that we read speaks again to learning to cooperate with each other, to get to know each other, and to always love, you know, as they mentioned, the sinner, not mm-hmm. the sin, but the sinner.
Right.
So, and maybe that's a sign of hope for us or something.
That is something we should take note of after just seeing in the quick amount of time, really, the end of the First World War and the Second.
Yeah.
And how it turned out afterwards.
Yeah, really, yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Father.
Okay.
Shall we close today?
Let's do. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.